Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia EV6, the fully electric EV6 with a range of up to 528 kilometres. For more, visit kia.com.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. As you may know, the Irish Times recently ran, they called it a competition, or it's addressed as a competition, the best place to live in Ireland in 2021. And the shortlists included Clonakilty, Galway City, Glasslough and Monaghan, Killarney and Kerry, Cabra in Dublin, Malahide in Dublin. And the winner was Waterford City. And the front page of the Waterford News and Star leads with that story. Waterford City simply states the best place to live in Ireland. Now, Jim Griffin is a councillor in Waterford. Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to the listeners, I suppose, especially the Waterford ones.
Okay. Well, what was your problem with the front page of the Waterford News and Star reporting?
I suppose it was an expression I just voiced, Joe, and I thought next to the Waterford City, the best place to live in Ireland, they had two little pieces, man assaulted in a pitch black street and a cheese plant set for a Supreme High Court fight. I just thought such was the prestigious award of Waterford getting the accolade. It just tarnished the piece, I thought. It just tarnished it by putting a bit of negativity front and centre.
Man assaulted in pitch black street. And was man assaulted in pitch black street?
I'm part of the Cultural Quarter steering group down in Hanover Street. The Cultural Quarter runs right through O'Connell Street and into that area, Joe. There's another newspaper operating out of there for numerous years, and there's a cafe there, and we also have the Architectural Science.
No, but was there a 59-year-old man assaulted?
There was, yeah, there was.
Then, so what's wrong with putting that? And it was a serious assault. And why? What's wrong with putting that on the front page of the Waterford News and Star?
Well, what I was going to say was that I those other industries and businesses that are there, never once did they contact, that I know of, the council or councillors to say it's pitch black. There is a couple of big trees there, but as you know, we can't cut trees till the spring-summer season is over. And the fact that this was such a prestigious award for Waterford, we're coming out of COVID. It's the longest 2 years, I think, since the emergency, Joe. I think this was an absolute brilliant piece for Waterford to get, and I just thought it tarnished it, albeit the man assaulted is a huge story, and so is the cheese plant, the Glanbia cheese plant for Waterford. I personally thought it could have been on the inside pages, and leave Waterford, take a bow and acknowledge the fact that we're the best place in Ireland to live.
But are the people of Waterford City so insecure that they need the Irish Times to tell them that they're the best place to live in Ireland?
Absolutely not, Joe. We've known it for years, but I suppose it was a kind of a hidden secret down here. And
one of the reasons it won it, according to the Irish Times. By the way, the competition was sponsored by Randox Health, who run the COVID clinics at Dublin Airport, but they're quite expensive. But they run the clinics, and they're very reputable.
Correct.
But they say one of the reasons that Waterford City won it is that Waterford mounted a great battle against COVID. Protecting, and what's that got to do with being the best place to live?
I suppose, Joe, we stepped up to the plate for our community and the people that live here, and we showed them that, like I just said, in the face of a worldwide pandemic, that we are there to support them. And all religions and creeds that live in Waterford City, they're all welcome here, and we will look after each and every one of them to the best of our ability, be it the council, the carers, our hospital teams, doctors and nurses.
That, but I think every place, in every village, town and community and city in the country did their best on COVID. Darren Skelton, stay there, Jim, please. Darren Skelton is speaking on behalf of the Waterford News and Star, which is Waterford's biggest selling local newspaper. And Darren, what do you think of this criticism? Why did you put bad news on the front page of your newspaper alongside such prestigious news from the Irish Times?
Joe, I think what you're asking me is, why did they put news on the front page of a newspaper?
Well, I'm not asking that. It's what Jim is objecting to.
I'm not too sure what Jim's agenda here is. I know where he's coming from in one respect, and which is why we gave the whole, you know, a large 80% of the front page to this story. And we have a fairly significant supplement coming out this week for the second edition. So, you know, we're squeezing it for every last drop because it is a very significant achievement. Sometimes a lot of people don't know how good we have it down here until maybe locals come down and sometimes show, you know, show a mirror in front of us. But at the end of the day, other things happen. And, you know, if you go on to the 6-1 news, they very rarely start with the fluffy good news story. Mm-hmm. If you look at the front page of all of the papers in the country, it's a, and the reality is, bad news does sell, but that's not what we're about here. We're about actually delivering what's the news. Now, Jim is on the Cultural Quarter Steering Group, so it's probably up to Jim to make sure that areas like that are not in complete darkness. I went down there the night after the assault, took a photograph of it. It is in complete darkness. I think as well as our job to inform people of the news, we should also try and maybe inform change, try and see that this, it is lit up for the following week. And if people didn't know that it was in darkness, then it would still be in darkness next week because maybe certain people are not doing their job.
Well, let me come at it another way, in fairness to Jim. Why did you lead with this story? What Twitter of difference has it made? I know the Irish Times owned the Waterford News and Star, isn't that correct?
Yeah.
That should be declared. But why would you lead with a story, a very reputable provincial newspaper going for a long, long time? Waterford City, the best place to live in Ireland, says who?
Okay, well, it's a good question. But if the Irish
says
Times,
three people in the Irish Times, they had they had 2,400 nominations. For no less than 470 separate places, which means every place nominated got four votes. How could that be a competition?
Well, look, that's not for me to answer. You know, I'm from Waterford. I'm born and bred in Waterford City. And if the Irish Times put it on the front page of their magazine and their paper, and the local paper do now, we led with it because it is something to shout from the rooftops about. And Waterford people in the past are probably guilty of something that maybe like the Cork people are not. Cork people know how good Cork is. Cork certainly do not have an inferiority complex. They probably have a superiority complex. Whereas Waterford people sometimes need to be reminded of how good things, you know, how things we actually do have it. We've got a lot of good amenities down here. It's our job as a local paper to try and improve the city all of the time, to inform people what's happening. You're playing a very, very good devil's advocate role there, but you're talking to two people from Waterford, and Jim loves Waterford as much as I love Waterford.
Yeah, I know.
You probably need to get somebody on from the other county.
Well, the only person I know who doesn't like Waterford is Gilbert O'Sullivan, Raymond O'Sullivan, who was born in Waterford.
O'Sullivan,
the great Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Waterford.
Well, he said, and we quote the Irish Times, no less, from 2004, which you have such respect for that you decide
a
competition. Well, who says so? I don't know. but a so-called competition which voted Waterford, you bet places like Cabra, Malahide, Glass, I'm sure these are all fantastic places to live. Derry, but I hope it's not referred to in the Irish Times. I see three cities, Derry/Londonderry, but I don't think that's a direct quote from the Irish Times. Galway, Waterford, Blackrock, County Louth, Bray, County Wicklow, Carrick and Shannon, County Leitrim. All you read about Carrick and Shannon lately is how the stag and hen parties are destroying the place. But anyway, that's who you bet.
Oh, lovely.
Now,
this is
what,
right.
Let me give you what Gilbert O'Sullivan, who was born in Waterford, said.
Okay, can I respond to that then?
Well, let me say it first. He said, I will never play in my native Waterford again. After a 1,000-seat theatre in the town was only half full for an appearance I made in the early 1990s. I was depressed after that. I locked myself in my hotel room. I couldn't understand it. They were obviously trying to tell me something. I won't play in Swindon either. or Jersey.
Yeah.
Now, there's Gilbert O'Sullivan. He was alone again. Naturally in Waterford, because his confreres and his fellow, you say yourself and Jim are now agreeing with each other because you're two Waterford people against.
But tell us
what Gilbert O'Sullivan said.
I spoke to Gilbert O'Sullivan during the lockdown. I spoke to him many, many times, right? I spoke to him about this. And now he won't play in his hometowns anymore because of what happened. And those, Swindon and Jersey, were his hometowns subsequent to Waterford, right? Now, I went back to look at the newspaper at the time. In the weeks leading up to a show. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, his press people did nothing. There was literally no mention at all, apart from a small little box, that he was even playing in the first place, right? Now, when I rang him, and he said, I'm only talking to you because you're from Waterford, he said. So he still has a lot of affection for Waterford. But I reminded him, I said, Gilbert, I just want to say to you, there was no press coverage, there was no advertising leading up to that show. And then I asked him, will you be coming back to play in Waterford? And he said, listen, I have a tour coming up, we'll sort it out, I'll be back. I think that's one another kind of a, another mountain out of an old hill type of story. But certainly Gilbert loves Waterford, and sure, what's not to love, as we've already said.
And
I have a similar experience there, Joe, too, with Gilbert. When I was the Deputy Metropolitan Mayor, I made contact with them.
Yeah, okay.
And it was similar.
Who else
will
did
be
he
back
got,
to Waterford.
No, tell us about the two you now have coalesced. Yeah. But Jim, what did Gilbert say to you?
It was through his social media, Joe, and I got through to his social media manager, and then they posted me through to Gilbert's own page, and it was similar. He loves Waterford, he loves a lot of everything about Waterford, and he will be back, and there was a coming tour. Now, that was 2.5-3 years ago, but I think the tour is only happening now because of COVID. But if you would give me a chance, Joe, to comment on Darren there, I do support local and national media, broadcasters and journalism, but I just think of coming out of COVID, like I said, the biggest pandemic or the biggest thing that has happened to country since the emergency, I think the onus is on journalists and broadcasters to put a good spin on news stories, be it front page or be it the first part of the news at times. Yes, there's big stories that can be negative, but I think It is. We have to be cognizant of people's mental health after this pandemic, and we should be trying to get people to look at good news stories, build it up, make it positive, and keep negative news inside.
Yeah, Darren,
okay,
go ahead.
But just to say to you, we're not a brochure for Fall to Ireland, as I've already said to you. We're a paper. It costs money to buy the paper. There's jobs on the line here. We have to sell as many newspapers as possible. As much as you and other politicians would love to set the agenda for what we have on the front page, I guarantee you, we look back on the sales of our papers, and whenever we have a front page great news story like, 500 new jobs or whatever it is, people don't buy the paper. But whenever we have a big story like that, whether it's, a newsy story, and sometimes it just so happens that newsy stories are court cases or they're murders or they're... We have stories sometimes of murders on the front page and we're giving out there. What are you doing putting that on the front page? It's not giving a great example of Waterford around the world. Come on, we're a news paper.
Inside the paper, Darren, we have the first Shannon-type lifeboat in Dunmore East. We have 3.7 million spent on the beautiful Mount Congreve gardens and houses. They could have accompanied the first piece of the best place in Ireland to live.
But they're not. But people want to know about serious assaults. That's the thing, Joe, Jim. That's the thing. People want to know about these things happening in their area. It's news. It's the very definition of news. And I'm actually shocked that I actually have to defend a newspaper putting news on the front page. As you've already said, we led with the great big positive story. And we're following up with a really big positive supplement, which has contributions from people like Mario Rosenstock and Keith Barry and loads of great Waterford people. But, as Joe has already said, it's a news story and it belongs on the front page.
And Keith Barry, who's one of our best entertainers in the country by far, and has been for a long time. But Keith always talks about, not always, when he's asked, he does talk about the attack on his own father, wasn't it, in Waterford City?
Yeah, because
no one has ever been convicted of.
These things happen, and he has every right to be aggrieved about that. Yeah. We've covered that story many times.
Yeah, my point is, attacks happen in Cabra, Malahide, but that's, I don't know how you determine what is the best place to live in Ireland. I just don't know how you do that.
We take in a lot of factors, and I suppose if you come down here, Joe, and we'd invite you down, and we'll give you a weekend, and we'll look after you, and we'll show you exactly why we won. Because you could be at any one place, and you're never going to be 10 minutes away from, great mountains, great beaches, great forests, great, and we have a lot of stuff going on in the city as well, which we have 5 museums, and you'll love a good museum, Joe. Come down and report from Waterford, and we'll show you. And then whoever wins next year, you can go there and report from there.
Yeah, but I don't think I much care. I don't think I much care what 3 or 4 people in any newspaper decide.
Well, we don't need to be told.
Exactly. So
you're
why?
Right. I agree with that.
So why is one? Why is it? Why are you leading with the story? Are you that insecure that you have to lead with the story that a few people in the Irish Times in a competition sponsored by Randox Health think you're the best place, and one of the reasons you're the best place to live in the country is you're such low COVID rates? I don't know if any area can determine how low their COVID rates are.
No, I don't.
But anyway, that's
not
here now. Okay, thanks indeed. Thanks, Darren. Thanks, Jim. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
By the way, the wonderful Gilbert O'Sullivan is going back on tour again, and in September 2022, he is in September 3, he's in the Royal Theatre and Event Centre in Castlebar and Mayo. On the 9th, he's in the Cork Opera House in Cork, and that's selling well. And on the 11th, he's in the Borgosh Energy Theatre in Dublin. Tickets still available. I don't see any mention of his native town of Waterford. And when Keith Barry was on here talking about the attack on his family, it was his granddad, Paddy Barry, a gorgeous, gorgeous man who was attacked in his home. Now, Aaron O'Neill, down to homes and housing crisis again. You are one of the many people we've spoken to over the last 12 days who is caught in the trap. Aaron, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. Tell us your situation.
Well, basically, it's one of the above mentioned best cities and our best towns in Ireland to live in, Clonakilty.
Okay.
We've been here for 16 years and we've been renting.
Okay.
We've rented 9 accommodations within that time.
Wow.
I have 3 kids and all 3 were baptized in different parishes. I have my eldest daughter has autism. And we've been going through a bit of a nightmare with the housing situation. We've been applying for a long time. My wife, she was told to that she needed to work after our youngest was born. He's now 2 years old. And he's had complications himself. He's had surgery at Crumlin Hospital. So we were told my wife should go out and work after he was born. And she does that, and we send him to childcare. Now, at the end of the week, when the childcare comes in, when the end of the week, when we pay everything off, we're left 15 euro to the better.
Oh, gosh.
So we've been turned down by every bank because...
and just to be clear, you've been turned down by the council as well because the income you have is over the threshold.
Yeah, now we spoke to the council. The council said, look, you earn too much for us to be concerned. What the banks told us, because my wife's job is seasonal work, because she's a preschool educator, that because of that, it's seasonal work and therefore doesn't count as income. So basically, she's been wasting her time for a long time working. We've been rejected at every level. We can't afford to rent anywhere that's out there. There's very little out there in Clonakilty, anywhere or anywhere around. Now, I know we could move somewhere else up the country and perhaps get a little bit cheaper rent. It's not really feasible, though, for us. You know, our eldest daughter has autism. She's in sixth class. She'll be going into first year next year. She's not even comfortable with the people she's around now, and after 6 years she's still adjusting to those people. It'd be a huge change to bring her somewhere else, you know, just for the sake of, because we can't afford the rent.
And the current property, which is your ninth rented property in Clonakilty, one of the best towns in Ireland, but the ninth property in 16 years, and when are you due to leave the current property?
We're due to leave the property in January.
And why?
The landlord is selling to try and cash in on the good market.
Okay.
So it's been our situation. It's happened in our last 3 properties that this same situation has happened.
That the landlords, as they're called, sold up and got out.
They sold up, yeah. So we're left where we're at the moment is we can't get a mortgage. We can't afford the rent anywhere around. You're talking 1,600 for a 3-bed. We can't afford it. And
you're not entitled to any housing assistance from the state?
No. I think the only plan that ever would have worked for us was the Rebuilding Ireland. Now, the first time we sent in an application, it went missing. And then second time, we were told the council doesn't have any money. So that doesn't leave us anywhere. I've no faith in what the government is about to bring out next week. I really, really don't. And the way we're looking at it at the moment is we're heading into this Christmas with the thought that we could be homeless in January. And we just don't seem to fit into we just don't seem to fit into anyone's category. And to be honest, it's terrifying.
And as you say, you're caught in the middle.
We're caught in the middle because I earn too much for the council to care, and I earn too little for the banks to care. So we're caught right in there. We're right in the middle. It's been years now we've been attempting to do this, and we're chasing our tail the whole time. You know, we spent many years chasing to try and get my daughter assessed for ASD because we knew there was something wrong.
Okay.
And we had to jump up and down and scream for that. And now it's this, but at this time we're not getting anywhere. You know, and we put that question to the council, said, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. We're going to be homeless in January. And they said, look, it's not our concern. So I don't know what to do. I really don't. We're at our last wit here, and we're struggling to cope, to be honest.
And even when you say, and you put it so well, and you've articulated what the calls we're getting in the last 12 days, I earn too much, we earn too much for the council to care, and we earn too little for the banks to care.
Yeah. And where my wife's job comes into it is that, like, she works, you know, this is the job that she wants to do. She's doing preschool. Well, ideally, she'd love to be at home with her child, you know, who's two and he's had health issues. And she can't do that because she was told you need to be out working and you need to show, even though some weeks we actually pay the babysitter more than we earn.
Why? So just explain that to me, Aaron, why she needs to show that she's out working.
This is something we were told by the banks, and we were told
the banks, in terms of... So you were really caught. On the one hand, if you didn't work, and a lot of people can't work or aren't able, in fairness, to get jobs, if you didn't work, or you weren't able to find work, you'd probably be... You could make it onto the council list or be eligible for rent allowance or whatever. But the fact that the banks are saying, well, listen, to try and get a mortgage off, to go the other way and try and get a mortgage, you need to have a steady income.
Yeah, exactly.
That we can record, yeah.
And what we're being told by, you know, told by the banks that Deirdre's job doesn't, my wife Deirdre, her job doesn't count. And, but then as the goodbye, we're told by the council, you earn too much because your wife's job counts. It's very contradictory.
And is there any other angle? I don't know whether you saw that. Incredible film with Claire Dunne, who was not just starred in it but had a big hand, she's in Kin at the minute with another great actor, Aidan Gillen, and Ciarán. And in another movie she made, she actually went in and said, I've found a bit of land, can you help me build a house which will cost 35k?
Okay.
Which will be much less than the state will have to give me.
Yeah, so I'll talk to you about that one.
Okay.
My parents-in-law very kindly offered us land.
Okay.
And where the land is 100 metres from where my wife's granddad was born, from where my father-in-law was born, and indeed my wife was born. We spoke to where we put in our planning application and flat out rejected. Because number one, you could see the sea from the land, therefore it was a no. And number two, we have no links to the area apart from that's where my wife's from.
Does that still exist, that awful apartheid rule that you, because you can't, remember Wicklow County Council would only allow Wicklow people, was it either build or buy houses, well, they couldn't stop people buying them, but build houses in Wicklow, crazy.
Yeah.
Apartheid. And remember, the county borders in Ireland, they've no relevance to anything apart from tribes that were controlling a disunited Ireland 600 or 700 years ago. But that's, stay there, Aaron. Brendan O'Connor.
Sure.
We're talking to Aaron O'Neill. Aaron has three children, both of them working. And as he says, we earn too much for the council to care and we earn too little for the banks to care, which means in the past 16 years, they've been living in 9 rented accommodations in and around Clonakilty. They've got I don't think it's an ultimatum, and I'll ask about that in a sec, but they've been told that the owner of the property wants to sell up and they need to be out in about 10 weeks coming up to Christmas. Now, Brendan O'Connor, you're in Nina. Brendan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you getting on?
Well, good. Your experience?
My experience is it's actually terrible for young people at the moment, especially people trying to get on the ladder. Mm-hmm. And number one, trying to rent a property at the moment is just possible for young people and older people as well. We put a property up for rent 3 days ago.
Okay.
I had 30 calls on the property. We had 20 viewings on the property. Mm. 19 out of the 20 people that viewed the property were eligible, could afford the house, had very good references.
Okay.
And we could only rent the house to one person.
Yeah.
And it was, and I had to ring the 18 people yesterday to tell them that they were unsuccessful.
Well, give us a glimpse into that then, Brendan, those phone calls.
Well, it was just terrible, because even when they came to view the property, I explained to them that there's an awful lot of inquiries on the property. But, I mean, there's people with children that are living in one-bed apartments with three children, and they're trying to get a bigger house, and they just can't find anything. And we're outside Nina, and you're in an area where mm-hmm. is... You where you think there's lots of property, it's hidden down here and in the country as well as Dublin and the major cities.
Well, I see from Tipperary Live, Tipperary house prices rise 9.2% in 3 months.
Correct, yeah. We put a property on the market and it's getting about 15 to 20% more than the asking price.
Wow.
And the other problem that is with it, Joe, as well, is that no one can get planning permission down here. Unless you're from the local area, and even at that, it's gone so stringent. My own son couldn't get planning permission because there was ribbon development in the area, so he packed his bags and headed back to out of the country again. It's just terrible what's happening, mm-hmm. and it's going to get worse. And one of my own problems is that if the government keep messing with the rentals, keep messing with the market, It's like a scab. If you keep picking at it, it'll get worse. And I think that's the major problem. And the cost of building has gone through the roof.
Well, we know, yeah.
It's just, if I go back to 1986 when I built my first house, mm-hmm. it cost me £23,000. But I put a roof over my head. I didn't have central heating. I didn't have double glazed windows. But I eventually put those things in. Today, you have to have everything. It has to be an A-rated house.
Yeah.
It has to be done to a certain standard, which costs an average of €200 a square foot. It's not possible for young people to buy a new house. You know, that's one of the major problems because of the environmental issues as well. That's why the standard is put there. But the standard has put people out of the housing market.
And this apartheid where people, and in using that word, I don't want to denigrate, to try and devalue what happened in South Africa, the horror. But this decision, so I withdraw that comparison. So this decision of local council to say, we will not give you planning permission unless you are from this area.
That's correct. At the moment, it's called local need. If you were in a rural countryside, not in a town or a village, mm-hmm. but if you were in a rural countryside and you were brought up in that area, you can apply for permission. And the local need, if you were lucky enough to get your planning permission, you have to live in that house for 7 years, so you can't sell the house. But the other issue with that is that they're not giving the permissions because of various reasons, because of... the local area plan says that you can't have ribbon development in an area, so and it has to be can't be viewed over a lake or whatever the situation may be. So it's gone very, very difficult for people to get on the ladder.
Yeah.
And next year they're changing the actual development plan again, that only a farmer's son can apply for planning permission, and the son has to have 20 acres in his name, and he has to be registered in the farm as well. That's the only person that can build. And then there's no builders building houses because the costs are so dear. So there's nothing being built. There's no encouragement from the county councils to build houses. There's extraordinary charges on planning fees.
Development fees.
Fees. Like, for an example, if before Irish Water came in you had a planning fee of, say, for a 2,000 square foot house of approximately 7,000 euros.
Mm-hmm.
So that came in. But when Irish Water took over, they couldn't charge that as part of the planning charge. So they had to deduct that fee.
Okay.
But what they did was they brought up all the other fees to the same price or by percentages on everything else. So that 7,000 still applied. But then you have to pay Irish Water separately. So you have another 2,000 or 3,000 euros to pay Irish Water on top of that 7,000 euros.
And where... I know things aren't easy in terms of running a country or running a council or running a local corporation. But given that every single day, non-stop, on radio and television, it's housing, housing, housing. And the government, they say, were being battered, no matter, they accuse Sinn Féin there of criticising the Housing for Ireland plan before it was even published. So they've been battered every day. But why can't they knock heads together? Why can't they say...
Absolutely. Well, I don't believe they're talking to the right people. People that are on the ground. I can see what's happening. I have seen it for years. I've seen this creeping in all the time. And people, where is it going to be in 5 years' time? Because we're not going to have a stock of houses built in that period of time. Because of the planning difficulties, number one, that's going to take years to sort out. Number two, the cost of building is not encouraging any builder to dig sod. It's just not there.
Yeah.
You know, it's. I mean, put it this way: we were lucky enough when we were brought up. Well, when we were building, that when we were young, we could afford to get onto the market. We paid a huge amount of interest rates, but at the same time, we were able to get onto the market because we could dribble ourselves onto it. You can't dribble onto it now. Now you have to go all out and pay.
Yeah,
after
everything has to be A-rated and
A-rated.
Before you can even put a key in the hall door. Now,
absolutely.
Now, Brendan, those awful 19 calls you had to make yesterday.
Yeah.
Insofar as you can generalise, like many of them would have been in the same position as Aaron and his family and the people we've talked to over the last...
Oh, very similar. Very similar.
Caught in the middle, not eligible
the
for...
They can't buy a house because of the cost, number one, and obviously they can't get to rent a house because they're not there. They're physically are not there.
So, Maren's point, I earn too much for the council to care and too little for the banks to be bothered.
That's exactly... Well, it's not about the banks being bothered because they have to look at the financial part.
And I know the central bank rules.
Exactly. Yeah, so they don't want to happen what happened in, say, 2007, where we have a massive drop. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah. They're watching. Okay. They're watching their end of things as well. But at the same time, it's the cost of building is the problem.
And that's so unpredictable at the minute, isn't
Absolutely.
It, because of the new world.
Yeah.
But Brendan, even Aaron's point, which you reiterated, that his father-in-law offered them a bit of land to build their own house beside where his partner was reared, and the decision makers in Clonakilty and Environ said no. What was the argument, Aaron? You didn't have enough connections with the area.
Well, we had no connection to the area.
But you lived there.
Yeah, but we have to live within 4 kilometres for 7 years beforehand.
And what do they do in these counties? Do they take your DNA before they let you to prove that you're from the area?
It would seem so, yeah.
Well, one of the reasons, Joe, what they actually do in the Tipperary County Council is you have to be 10 years living in the area and not have had a house before, so that it's your first, you've never had a house in your name.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have either school records for 10 years or proof that you've lived in the area for 10 years without having owned a house before. That's the criteria.
Where are the people who will knock heads together and say this is an emergency?
Yeah, it is an emergency, and it starts at planning. It starts at planning and then it works its way through to the costing. And even the planning fees are extortionate as well when someone goes to build a property.
Okay.
You know, before they even build a sod, you know. So
From what you're saying, and indeed the way you're saying, Brendan, I can't imagine what it was like for you yesterday to make those 19
terrible
phone calls.
Terrible. I felt it was my fault. Do you know what I mean? And it's not my fault, because I would have liked to rent the house to everyone that looked at the house. We made lovely people, very respectable people, had good references. And it was just so sad. I just said, it broke my heart, to be honest with you, to ring them and tell them, you know, especially people with kids, you know.
Yeah. And how did the people react generally?
They were very nice about it,
yeah.
To be honest with you, you know, and I will endeavour to try get them a house somewhere at some stage or when something comes up, but they're not coming up. That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not there.
And Aaron, I was going to ask Brendan, given his knowledge of the business, of the any ideas, but the only idea, Aaron, I can think of is that could you go back to the council and say, is that land, bit of land you were offered still available?
Yeah, well, yeah, it is still available, yeah. But to be honest, I don't think we're going to get anywhere. We were told initially from the get-go, as soon as they looked at it, not a chance. You can see the sea from where you are. So that would be a no straight away. Secondly, no connection to the area. Yeah. So we will go back to them, but we already know what we're going to hear, and we've been told what to expect to hear.
How long have you been in the area for, Aaron?
16 years.
16 years. You're well yeah. qualified for the local need. Now, I'm not aware of the planning in your location, as I would be in Tipperary, but I would say you do have a fighting chance to go back and get your planning. But at the same time, are you going to be able to afford to build a house on the site when you get your planning permission?
That's the other thing. Yeah, and we've been kind of weighing up that.
Yeah,
you know, we have had our eyes set on a few different properties now in the last few weeks, and then it all has fallen through with banks.
And what are rents like in Clann?
Pardon?
What are rents like down there?
They have increased. Places that were renting for 700-800 are now 1600. 18 months later.
It's unaffordable.
It is very unaffordable. But even going looking at a house, they ask if you're a cash buyer or not. If you're looking to buy, they ask if you're a cash buyer or not. And if you're not a cash buyer, then you go down onto a second list where they'll call you if no one else puts an offer on. So, you know, it's a very unfair market.
It is an unfair market. And then, you see, we have to look at when we put a property on the market and it's up for sale at a particular price, either they show that they have their mortgage approval, which would be the same as a cash buyer. There's no such thing as cash. It means that you're ready to go. It doesn't mean that you're in the chain or whatever the situation would be. And maybe you're not able to put in an offer because you don't have the mortgage approval to hand. Are you with me? So if you had your mortgage approval to hand, then you'd be able to move forward.
We've often had our AIP, and that's when we get turned down after that. They go to the underwriters and they inevitably find an issue with my wife's job.
Yeah,
and they discount it as being a job, as being a source of income. So that's kind of where we're being let down at the moment. But yes, we were told a few years ago, look, when your wife has the baby, she should go back to work, and the job she's in, you know, that's all that we'll need.
Yeah,
but it hasn't transpired that way. It's turned out the opposite. So we're back to, you know, the situation again, and we're back to where are we going to be in January.
Yeah.
And I have to say as well, my eldest daughter, you know, the fact that she has autism means that she's constantly, you know, if we're going somewhere, we went camping this summer. For a month before we went camping, we had to show her pictures almost daily of where we were going so she could visualize it. But now we have to tell her, look, we're moving out in January and we don't know where we're going to be.
Terrible.
And it's terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, it's awful.
And we all using daft.ie was a letting agency. It's a description of the housing situation in Ireland at the minute. Daft.ie. It's crazy. It is crazy.
It is certainly crazy. Gone daft, yeah.
And by the way, just as I mentioned, daft, I'm told daft.ie have zero properties to rent in Clannachilty, for example, at the moment.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. And the property we put up the other day was the first property we've had in a long time to rent out. It's just that's the way the market's gone.
Okay. Aaron O'Neill, to you and your family, kind regards. And Brendan O'Connor, likewise, in Nina. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 is the text number, and 1850 715 815 is the phone.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
I think a lot of people would have seen the photographs and indeed the images on TV of 28-year-old Nayab Tariq, who died on March the 22nd, 2020, after giving birth to her first child with her husband, Ayaz, in Mayo University Hospital. But to put a story and a personality on those beautiful photographs against that awful, tragic story, Ayaz Al-Hassan is on the phone now. Ayaz, good afternoon, and condolences, first of all, on the tragic passing of your wife. Can you tell us about how you met and I know you want to pay tribute to her, but tell us how you both met.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Joe, and thank you for your condolences and description. We met our parents in Pakistan, okay. And we got engaged in 2014. You know, straight away we knew this was going to be a lifelong relationship, and and we clicked straight away. So after about 4 years of engagement, we got married in February 2017. And after that, obviously, you know, once you're married, and then because I was in Ireland, I moved back, and then there's a whole process of visa application and the waiting period, which takes approximately 6 to 9 months.
Okay.
So as soon as I moved back to Ireland, I applied for a visa, and we were one of the lucky ones that her visa application got approved pretty fast. And it was around, I think, November time frame of 2017. And I remember talking to her that day. She was very, you know, wearing a very, very nervous voice and yet excited to, you know, because this would have been her first time flying. And she said, she said that, how am I going to be flying over on my own? You'll have to come and get me.
You know? All right. Yeah.
And that's just something that's been with me, you know, since the incident. And I can't get that voice out of my head. But, you know, so moving on, then unfortunately with the work circumstances, I wasn't able to go. So my uncle was there in Pakistan at that time, who was also coming back around the same date. So she moved over in February 2018. Which was actually on the 24th of February, and 25th of February would have been our wedding anniversary. So it was nice from that perspective.
That was obviously, because it was her first flight, that was obviously Nayab's first time in Ireland. What did she think of this very different country to Pakistan?
Yeah, so, you know, it wasn't easy for her to leave all her friends and family behind to move over. And I remember greeting her at the airport, and first thoughts were, it's very cold, you know, it's very chilly.
Yeah, yeah.
As you can imagine, in February time frame. So on the way home, I remember once we got off the motorway off Athlone, and the road between Athlone to Roscommon, you know, it's quite scenic. There's a lot of countryside fields and all that. So, you know, she observed all that, and she said to me, geez, there's an awful lot of greenery here. And I'm loving this already.
Okay.
And then after a couple of days in Ireland, there comes a pouring of rain, you know, for a couple of days straight. Yeah. And she's like, oh, I'm not liking this side of Ireland. But, you know, it was all new experience for her, different country, new people, new location. Leaving everything behind wasn't easy for her. And at that time, I was working in Cork. And I was actually listening to the story before this about the housing crisis. Straight away, I couldn't bring her to Cork simply because of the similar situation of the housing crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't able to afford it. So we decided that, you know, she's going to spend some time here in Mayo Ballyhannis, because number one, there's a big Pakistani community here, and she'll have age fellows around, and my brother's wife also, you know, everyone around, they welcomed her with open arms. It was never like an outsider, you know, it was very much like a family. So everyone here got along great with her. She was in general, you know, very outgoing, sociable, likable personality. I mean, and was if you've spoken to her...
Was there any indication when your wife became pregnant that there was that there was problems with the pregnancy?
So throughout the whole pregnancy, there was no issue at all. Everything was as normal as expected, and and we established that through our antenatal clinics that we had been attending. It was just that towards the last couple of weeks, her platelet count had been dropping, and that is something that all the medical staff was aware of when they were monitoring. So other than that, she didn't have any medical implications.
But at the inquest into what happened, your dear wife, which saw her dying as she gave birth to your fourth child in Mayo University Hospital, the inquest concluded that uncovered delays in ordering diagnostic blood readings, miscommunication between medical staff, and missed periods where basic but essential observations like blood pressure and temperature should have been taken. So I presume, yeah. I presume part of your reason for going public is you want people to be. I know in the main people are vigilant, but people just have to be extraordinarily vigilant around childbirth. Medical staff, obviously. Now, when they say miscommunication, that wasn't on the part of NIAB. I presume she had as good English as you do, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So there wasn't a language difficulty when they talk about miscommunication.
No, not at all.
Okay.
So the miscommunication, when they speak about miscommunication, it wasn't between NIAB or the doctor. So the miscommunication was between the staff amongst themselves, between the doctor, for example, your labour ward staff and your operation theatre staff. So the miscommunication was there. Miscommunication wasn't between NIAB and the doctor.
Okay, and NIAB was a biopharmacist, so she could use descriptions well.
Absolutely.
Now, when did she go into the hospital? When did you decide to go in?
So she went into she started having contractions on the 22nd of March morning.
Okay,
and we straight away rang the labour suite, and they said, "Yeah, you should come in."
Okay.
And we presented at the hospital between 9:30 to 10 a.m. and she was admitted into the labour ward room 4. And that's where all the events occurred. And just speaking about her background as well, she was well aware of her own situation because she had studied microbiology in Pakistan, and she had a master's in that as well. And when she moved over, she started. Mm-hmm. She decided to do postgrad in biopharmaceutical. And
so your constructions started at 7 a.m. on the morning of March 22. And then what time did you arrive at the hospital?
So we were in hospital between 9:30 to 10 a.m.
Okay.
time frame. We were there in the hospital.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what happened during the day then? Contractions, they were normal.
So as you would expect, everything was normal. Contractions were at regular intervals, as expected. Everything, being monitored. And then once the water broke, and it was quite fast after the water broke that the baby was delivered, actually. And with the delivery of the baby, there was a gush of blood.
Okay.
And part of the blood had trickled down on the right-hand side of the bed. Which I believe, and that's something that stuck in my mind.
Okay, alarm bell should have rang.
And my concern was there. I had been asking questions, and it clearly wasn't the case with the medical staff that was present at that time. They didn't seem like my anxiousness was there. I was raising concerns, but that wasn't the case with the medical staff that was present at that time in the room.
And when did it become obvious that the situation was getting extraordinarily serious?
So they didn't it they didn't realise that until after he was in the operation theatre.
Okay.
And at one point, one of the anaesthetists that said that the correlation between the number of medication that they have to use and the volume of the medication that they have to use, considering the blood loss, it doesn't correlate, it doesn't match with the situation that they're seeing on the monitor. And that's when the questions start raising and the alarms start raising. Why do we have to use an awful lot of medication than what we know about the blood loss?
Okay, we know, we know the coroner returned a verdict of medical misadventure. And when then Nayab was given a general anaesthetic, and when were you told the bad news, the awful news, the horrific news?
So it was around, 9 that night.
So about 12
nine
hours.
9 time frame, yeah.
So those 12 hours changed your life.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we went into the hospital expecting best day of our lives. And it just turned out to be completely opposite.
Yeah.
While, you know, that happiness part is overshadowed by the news that I received on that day. And the communication part of it was so poor. I had been requesting update. I had been questioning everyone that I could. Because I had the baby in my hand, I couldn't leave the room.
Yeah.
And so I just had to sit there, anxiously wait for someone to come in and tell me what's happening. And I just had that feeling in me, you know, something's gone wrong, terribly wrong, but no one's telling me what was wrong.
Yeah.
And then five minutes before, one of the midwives, I think, she walked in and she said everything is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just trying to find out the cause of the blood and, you know, why it happens. And 5 minutes later, I got this news.
And then the fact now is that the anniversary of your child's birth, or i.e. that is her birthday, is also the anniversary of your wife's passing.
I mean, there's always going to be that note of that sadness attached to my daughter's birthday. And, I mean, it's...
Okay, let's. I think one of the, I hope one of the main things that comes out of this eye is that other medics will read the case and try and learn from it.
That's the whole point of going public with this. I mean, if you look in the past, for the likes of Sean Rolette or James Campbell, you know, they've been through a similar scenario. In one would think that, you know, we're a developed country. And we have all the latest technology, up-to-date training methods, protocols, procedures, they're all in place. And yet, when something like this happens, it makes you want to think, oh, really, you know, and those protocols, those procedures, trainings, everything's in place, but they're no good if they're not followed. And we've seen this time in and out again, you know, no lessons have been learned from Sean Rolette's wife's case.
Yeah,
I mean,
that was another case
James
of reference.
Campbell,
yeah.
Or
yeah.
James Campbell's daughter.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
So it just shows you no lessons have been learned, and this is still happening, and this should not be happening in today's day and age, given the technology
and there has to be
that's
learning
available
from it, and communication, and the people, there has to be learning from it. Your daughter, Nayab, who was born on March 22nd, 2020, how is she doing?
She's doing great. She's thriving here, thank God.
Okay.
You know, she's doing all sorts of things, and babies do, and... Yeah,
okay.
She keeps us busy, keeps us on our toes.
Yeah, well, above all, I ask condolences on the death of your beautiful wife at age only 28, Nayab Tariq. May she rest in peace. Ayaz, thank you so much, and kind regards to your baby and your family, your baby Nayab as well, called in honour of your beautiful wife. Thanks indeed, Ayaz. Thanks for talking to us, and look after yourself. Be good to
yourself.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And joe@rt.ie. Contacted by Jesse Mortensen and Amanda Santry. Jesse's in Offaly and indeed Amanda's in Tullamore in County Offaly as well. Jesse, this is an awful situation. Unfortunately, are going to be we'll be hearing more of them as the numbers, on the one hand, thankfully, in hospital from the pandemic decrease. What is your situation with your daughter, Rosie?
Yeah, so my daughter, Rosie, was born with spina bifida and hydrocephalus, and she's a full-time wheelchair user. So back in September 2019, we met with her orthopaedic surgeon, Conor Green, in Temple Street, and he decided she needed to have kind of minor enough operation done, just some tendon releases and stuff. So, look, I suppose COVID and all hit, and, you know, we weren't expecting that to be done very quickly, but he was hoping by December 2019. So by October 2020, we still didn't have a date. So I contacted Temple Street and organised another appointment with Mr. Green. So we met him in December 2020, and his team x-rayed Rosie, and the x-ray revealed that one of her hips had become dislocated. So, okay. Unfortunately, look, his team couldn't offer me a date for surgery at that time.
Okay.
So, as it proceeded then, I contacted risk management in the hospital and lodged a complaint, followed all their complaints procedures. Then I was told, look, we still don't have a date, that I was to request an internal review to be done within the hospital. With the CEO of the hospital, I'd done that. I still didn't get a response from that. So by March of this year, I decided to lodge a complaint with the Ombudsman for Children. So after that, basically, look, April, we had kind of a generic letter from the hospital saying, look, we're sorry for the delays, COVID, you know, cyber attacks, whatever, you know, and access to theatres was all an issue. So anyway, as time went on, I eventually got another appointment to see Mr. Green the 9th of September this year, as I was really concerned. Her condition has deteriorated very rapidly. She can't sit on the floor and play anymore. She needs to use her hands to support her. She can't go in any of her postural supportive equipment, which is going to cause her scoliosis to deteriorate as well, which is going to lead to further surgeries down the road.
And we were told, when were we told that scoliosis was so serious and so,
yeah,
it's so time, it gets worse over time. Time is so critical, so critical.
Yeah.
But we were told, I think it was the Minister of Health at the time, Simon Harris, that scoliosis was going to be a priority.
Well, this is it. And look, at the moment, her scoliosis isn't severe enough to need any interventions. But it is looking at us right in the face. That's what we are heading towards, because we can't have her sitting in any of her proper equipment,
yeah,
to keep her in that nice straight position that you need to be in to avoid the scoliosis deteriorating.
And how long, Jesse, at this stage, how long is Rosie waiting?
So she's waiting now since September 2019. So that was only to be very minor. It's now quite an extensive surgery.
So it's now 2 years later, such a critical age.
Yeah, so basically, we got a date on the 9th of September. We got a date for this Monday, the 4th of October,
yeah,
which was brilliant. We had everything sorted, you know, time taken off work, everything was rearranged for to have this done. I had kept her out of school all this week to make sure she wasn't going to get any coughs or colds or anything that was going to stand in her way of having this done. And I got a phone call yesterday to tell me that there's no beds and that I wasn't even offered a new date
So it's gone. It's gone.
It's gone. Yeah.
Say that, Jesse, because Amanda Santry, I want to bring Amanda in as well. And Amanda, I know you're involved in an advocacy group with the Spina Bifida and Hydrocephalus organisation, yeah, in Ireland. Have other families been getting these calls over the last 24 hours?
Not even over the last 24 hours, over the last 6, 12, 18 months. This is an ongoing problem, Joe. an ongoing problem I face with my own son. My own son, PJ, is 16 and he is also has spinal bifida and hydrocephalus. We spoke 5 years ago. My son was one of the children embroiled in the scoliosis scandal, okay, who was left so long he became inoperable. My son's inoperable because he was left so long on a waiting list.
And that is the ticking clock I was talking about earlier on, that it becomes so critical that you then unfortunately go up to the top of that hill and you keep going because you don't go down to the other side because it's inoperable.
No, now we were very lucky. We were also patients of Conor Green's. Conor took us on as a second opinion because I thought the HSE could get a second opinion. And he transferred his care to his service and he has stopped TJ from deteriorating. My son is currently an inpatient in the National Rehabilitation Hospital because he suffered an acquired brain injury in a hospital setting 2 years ago. And it took me 2 years of fighting to get my son a play.
And the stories you're hearing now in the last, you say, 6 to 12 hours, people haven't been waiting on operations for how long? And you say they're now being told that the date we gave you was gone and we've no new date.
No, I spoke to 16 families this morning in relation who all have a child with spina bifida and or hydrocephalus, and they have all, in the last 12 months, their children are all waiting over 12 months for surgery. They have been told that they're simply languishing on waiting lists, their surgeries have been cancelled and not rescheduled, or they're just sitting there. One parent told me that there is 500 children ahead of her child.
Oh no.
And these are children, like the greater public, like, and I know if I have other children will say, I'd go without food to make sure my child would get the surgery that they need. That's not an option for us. Our children are complex children with complex medical needs. Yeah. We were never offered outsourcing. When the outsourcing was going to the UK and Germany, complex children were never offered outsourcing. We have to be seen within the children paediatric setting in Ireland.
Yeah.
We're not being prioritised. Rosie's surgery has been cancelled on Monday. That surgery is going to be filled because there's no bed for it with day cases. So, and 6 or 7 or 8 children are going to come in. They're going to have minor procedures done by a fantastic orthopaedic surgeon who is pulling his hair out. And they're all going to be taken off the waiting list, and the numbers are going to be massaged. Where children like my son or Jess's daughter Rosie are left to languish and left to deteriorate. We're not getting anything. The services are so poor. And like, it's not the doctors within the services. They're doing their best. The system is broken. It's pitted against our children.
And as you say,
it's absolutely broken.
Yeah.
You know, and we're getting
it's so sad like that to think, you know, we went through all of the channels, all the correct channels to get a date, and we got our date and it was brilliant, and we had a surgeon who wanted to operate, and we had a theatre that was free, and then it was taken because there was no beds. You know,
and then I presume Jesse and Amanda, as we mentioned the pandemic, I presume given the condition that your beautiful children are in, that they have to be extraordinarily conscious of COVID. And bring
absolutely, of course.
Yeah, we've always had to be. We've had to be very, very careful with our children going forward from the pandemic, because to some level they would be immunocompromised. The same level as cancer patients, but they would be, and we have to be careful. Scoliosis causes massive problems with internal organs. We have to be very, very careful. But the problem is, Joe, and I'm not, like, the pandemic is there. It's very real. It's been very real for all of us. But the pandemic has been used as an excuse. Like, these are historical problems for children with spina bifida and hydrocephalus. These just didn't erupt over the pandemic.
Yeah.
They've been there. My son was 5 years ago.
And Amanda, I think you were on with us before, long before the pandemic, making that point so strongly.
Yeah, I set up the paediatric advocacy group in 2018 when we started hitting major barriers in teachers' care. Mm-hmm. And when we set that up, I think I naively thought that the HSE weren't aware of the issues, and that once we put ourselves forward, communicated with them, that we would find a way to move forward progressively to make things better for these children. And not just, like, we have about approximately 600 children with spina bifida and hydrocephalus in Ireland under the age of 18. like, you have cerebral palsy Ireland, Down syndrome Ireland. These categories are all falling into the same thing. It wasn't that the HSE didn't know what was going on. It's that they didn't care.
Yeah,
the powers that be only care about massaging the numbers.
Yeah.
And Rosie is going to be a victim to that now come Monday.
Okay. It's an awful situation for you both, and you're living it every minute of every day and going to be continue living it. And then the problem is the ticking clock, that it gets to a stage where it's inoperable. Amanda Santry and your family, and Jesse Mortensen, thank you both for contacting us.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie. Emma, good afternoon. Back to this people caught in the middle. That incredible phrase that was used earlier by Aaron. We were earning too much for the council to care, and we're earning too little for the banks to be bothered. Emma, good afternoon.
Hiya, Joe. How's it going?
What's your situation? Yeah.
So we're similar. We're renting at the moment. Been renting all our lives. You know, we've never missed a payment. We've got savings for a deposit on a house. So a couple of years ago, we applied for a mortgage with the banks and got refused. And then we had enough refusals to apply for the Rebuilding Ireland mortgage, which is the government scheme for people in lower income households. And we got refused from that. So we tried the council, and, you know, we're above the threshold for any support you can get from them. So we're stuck in the middle, and I call it a bureaucratic gap. You know, we're just stuck in the middle of these two fences. And once we're out of this rental situation, which is temporary, I don't know what we're going to do. Like, I'm looking for work to up our income, but we have two kids, and if we put them into childcare, you know, are we going to qualify for a mortgage at that point? Because then our outgoings are going to be massive. So we're just...
Yeah, that'll be, if you put them as, I'm sorry the line is so bad, but when you put them, as we discovered through so many people that have been on the air over the last 2 weeks, when you put them into childcare, then you end up with having very, very, very little take-home income. And the banks look at that and say, well, hang on a minute, how can you afford a mortgage because you have so many outgoings? And then the bank wants you to work because the bank wants evidence of consistent income before they'll give you a mortgage. It really is. It's an awful catch-22. It really is.
Yeah, and that's the exact situation we're in. We have two kids, and it was grand when we had one and my partner was working shift. I could work in the gaps, you know, when he was off work. I worked freelance, and the banks were looking at that and saying, OK, we'll wait until you've got 3 years of books to show us.
Yeah.
And now I have two, one young baby and one toddler, and it's become a little bit more difficult to work in between the gaps, if you know what I mean. And I'm just looking at childcare now and going, hang on a second. And what we do have, we have the National Childcare Scheme, which is support. Yeah. But it still adds up to the guts of the cost of a mortgage, do you know what I mean? And I don't know why the government aren't supporting parents who want to take care of their children themselves rather than farming them out to... to childcare. Like, that's a whole other conversation. I'm sure you've had it a million times.
Yeah, and it is. Well, the whole situation can only be described as one phrase. It's daft to .ie at this stage. There's no joined up thinking, it seems. It can be done. And I'm cognizant. We heard it a lot when Fine Gael in the last election, the slogan was, we're going to, for a change, start looking after people who get up early. I know people took offence to that, but get up early in the morning and go to work or whatever you can go to work. But like the people we've been hearing about in the last 2 weeks, as I say, are caught in the middle. They earn too much for the council to care, and they earn too little for the banks to be bothered. It's an awful situation, an awful situation. And the Rebuilding Ireland, what happened on that one, Emma? That scheme?
So we only applied to one council. We live in Cork, and we applied to the Cork County Council. And I talked to a friend who actually got it recently, and she applied to all the councils in Ireland. So we could keep going with that. But we got refused that one application we did. We met all their criteria. We have the savings for a deposit. We met, you know, like, we ticked all their boxes, basically. And we got refused on 3 points. They said to me, we don't have enough take-home income at the end of the day to support a family of four. Which is not true. We've never missed a bill. We've never missed a rent payment. You know, we actually are managing to save money still. So that's not true. They also said, you know, our savings are from when I was working in a full-time job 2 to 3 years ago. So they said we can't demonstrate, you know, that we've saved money, but we have. And, like, they're very decent. I talked to them on the phone and they were helping me to figure out how we could get it next time I apply. And basically they're saying because they couldn't take my income into account, which is a small amount, but it would add up, you know, to get it maybe adds up.
Yeah, and then the banks, on the other hand, will tell you, well, we've central bank rules. We can only, we need so much proof of a deposit. So much we need a deposit, basically. There's no 100% mortgages anymore. And then we told the reason why there isn't 100% mortgages because of the crash in 2007, 2008. But which you paid for, and we all paid for it, except the banks, of course. Okay, Emma, go to me, and I hope things for so many people today work out a lot better. Back tomorrow, 1:45. Annette Egan produced, and Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia e-range of EVs and PHEVs.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815. Stays open until 3:15 p.m. Or email joe@rte.ie.